This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful that you all are here. I'm always curious how people got here. Raise your hand if you found out about this from KBOO. How about KPOJ? How about Powell's? What about from Barbara Ellis? Yeah. What am I missing? Anything?
That was United Progressives.
Okay, United Progressives. Nobody. Facebook. Good, good to know. It's wonderful to be at a unionized bookstore with longshore and warehouse workers setting up the chairs. It's a beautiful thing. And I have to thank Barbara Ellis for all of her help in everything over the years and bringing me here, as well as David Rovics. And it was wonderful to see Tom Hartman today, and Linda Wiener, who's here, and Joe Walsh, and Joe anybody, and this is a rich community for activism, even from the viewpoint of somebody who lives thousands of miles away. My book takes a particular perspective on the incredible failures of our national government, which, as no one here needs to be reminded, is corrupted by a lot of forces and rarely supports the view of the majority of Americans. It's corrupted, obviously, by media, by money, by parties, by elections that are not verifiable, and so forth. And so it's a difficult case to make to some people that it matters where in this almost completely corrupt government the power lies. You know, why should we take the power away from the presidency and give it to the Congress when the Congress is completely useless and won't do anything good with it? And you know, the answer to that, I think, is that not everything is accomplished with one step. Not everything can be achieved immediately and easily. If we are going to have any chance in the future of ever controlling our government in Washington, it's going to come first through the House of Representatives. It is far, far easier, impossible and crazy as it might sound, to influence the House of Representatives than it is to influence the Senate, or the President, or the Federal Reserve, or the Supreme Court. It is much, much easier to go after the House of Representatives, and that's true now with everything as corrupted as it is. It's true next week if the Supreme Court makes it worse in the Citizens United case. It's true in the coming months and years if we accomplish some of the reforms we want to accomplish in terms of those corrupting factors. So it matters where the power is. And right now it's where John Yoo wants it. John Yoo has a book out too, in which he concludes with words of praise for the current president following through on the abuses of power of the previous president. And for once, I think the only time I can recall I am in agreement with John Yoo, except that I don't praise it. I denounce it as incredibly dangerous and misguided. But we have presidents now with the power to spy on you without a warrant, to lock you up without charges, without process, to send you to another country to be tortured, to torture you, to launch wars, to launch military strikes, to escalate wars without asking anyone's permission, to make treaties without the Senate, to make appointments without the Senate, to spend money without the Congress, to spend money in secret, to operate in secret, to make laws with signing statements and executive orders and secret memos and telling Congress what laws to make, and simply to violate laws with impunity and to grant people not just pardons but retroactive immunity without telling us who or why or for what. And these are powers that Bush and Cheney drastically expanded upon in their co-presidency. The trend of moving power to the White House began with George Washington. It's not new, and it's been cumulative, and presidents have not tended to give back the powers accumulated by their predecessors, but it took an incredible leap forward with Bush and Cheney. And the new Congress and the new president could have come in and said, we're not going to accept that. We're going to undo that. It would have been absolutely shocking. I think it would have violated some laws of physics for the new president to give back powers. You know, nobody becomes the president of the United States who is not power mad. Nobody puts themselves through that, what it takes to become president. But what's unique in our age is that Congress has no interest in power. Congress doesn't want it. Here, Mr. Emperor, take it. It's yours. We don't want to vote on wars. Somebody's going to be offended either way we vote. You deal with wars. And Congress no longer has any sense of loyalty to Congress because their loyalty is all to one or the other of the two branches of our government, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And at any given time, roughly half of Congress is loyal to the guy who was supposed to execute the will of Congress, the president, because he's the leader of their party. How many of you have heard of a guy by the name of Jay Bybee? This is my room. I spoke last night in Seattle, a block away from a courthouse where Judge Jay Bybee sometimes sits, and about 2% of the people in the room, and it was a bigger room than this, had ever heard of Mr. Bybee. Mr. Walsh has a $4,000 reward out for Mr. Bybee. For those of you who don't know exactly who he is, Jay Bybee, B-Y-B-E-E, Bybee, impeachbybee.org to learn more, was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, who was asked by the CIA and by Alberto Gonzalez as counsel for the president and others to commit the most serious crimes imaginable, and who wanted to be a judge. And he made a deal. He said, I'll do it if you make me a judge. And he did it, and they made him a judge, and he has a lifetime seat on the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit in Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and Los Angeles. And he famously signed memos legalizing torture. Personalized custom torture laws, how you can torture this guy, how you can torture that guy. And that should be a footnote in what he did, because he signed memos that were treated as laws in secret that legalize aggressive war at the whim of any future president. This is the supreme crime. This is mass murder. Legally, this is mass murder. His name is at the bottom of these memos that are no longer secret. And he is sitting there as a judge for life, overturning the rulings of decent judges in our system because no one wants to go after him. Last spring, when these memos came out, Senator Patrick Leahy asked Mr. Bybee if he would come in and talk. And Mr. Bybee said he wasn't inclined. And Senator Leahy said, I'm sorry I bothered you. And that was it. You'll recall that early in 2006, we were told nobody would be impeached no matter what. And for 2 years, they didn't impeach anybody, but they subpoenaed everybody. And everybody said, go Cheney yourself, and refused to comply with the subpoenas, including Cheney and Condi and the rest of them. And in 2009 and the first week of 2010, how many of those subpoenas have been reissued? None. It was a game. It was a charade. It was no more honest than anti-war activism from people who don't oppose wars when the president is a Democrat. It was a charade. And so Congress can only recover its power as a branch in our government if Jay Bybee and people like him are held accountable by Congress. And nobody else is going to do it, and there's nobody we can more easily influence. You guys know what inherent contempt is, right? A couple people nodding their heads. Inherent contempt is when you see Dick Cheney come on the television, this feeling that overtakes you. Inherent contempt is the power that any congressional committee has to enforce a subpoena itself without asking anybody else, without going to the Justice Department, without taking anybody to court, to the inherent power to preserve the existence of the first branch of our government by enforcing subpoenas. This has to be brought back. Somebody this year has got to be subpoenaed, and because the new Justice Department won't enforce them any more than the old one, a congressional committee has to enforce its own subpoena. And they have to begin the threat of impeachment of people like Jay Bybee. When a congressman from Washington State put in a one-sentence bill that said the House Judiciary Committee shall consider whether to impeach Alberto Gonzalez, Alberto Gonzalez quit and left town. Now there is not a single Congress member with the nerve to put in that kind of a bill on anybody like Jay Bybee. The media wouldn't like it. He's not a Democrat. There was no sex involved. There's not grounds for impeachment. This is what they will tell you. I'm not making this up. I'm not joking. This is what the House Judiciary Committee will tell you. The media would not like it. The party leadership will not permit it. There are not 435 people in the House of Representatives. There are two. There are the people who obey the Democratic leadership and the people who obey the Republican leadership. The parties pay for their campaigns, the parties give them earmarks, the parties run challengers against them, the parties give them chairmanships and bills. They are servants of their parties. And there was a willingness to go after Gonzalez because he was a Republican. And there is not a willingness to go after Bybee now because it's now Obama's crime. These crimes are now being protected and continued by a president who's a Democrat. There is a report that's been completed for years by the Justice Department itself on Bybee and John Yoo and their colleagues and their misconduct, produced by the Office of Professional Responsibility, the OPR report. And we haven't been permitted to see it for years. And in November, the Attorney General promised it would be out in November. And then there was a delay in a case that one of the victims of these torture policies is bringing against John Yoo for financial damages. These people are being sued in civil cases for crimes they have not been indicted for, that the president has announced publicly they cannot be indicted for. And presumably because the White House and the Justice Department, which serves the White House, not justice, do not want Jose Padilla's lawyer to have this report, it is still not out. And the bar associations are saying they won't disbar any of these lawyers until this report comes out. The congressional committees are saying they won't hold hearings or subpoena or impeach anybody until this report comes out. The Justice Department is, of course, not prosecuting anybody until this report comes out, all of which may be other reasons why the report is not coming out. Tomorrow, there will hopefully be news stories. A group of lawyers that I'm working with are filing a Freedom of Information Act request for the report, for the previous version of the report, for Attorney General Mukasey's rebuttal of the report, and for all the documentation of the unprecedented process of allowing the subjects of the report to edit it and water it down. This is a report they sent to you and Bybee to get their edits on. So watch for that announcement. But I want to stress that it's not just about torture. And we love to talk about the torture and call these guys the torture lawyers, but they legalized aggressive war. They legalized it. And the bulk of their argument in some of these memos consisted of Bill Clinton did it, right? Just as they denounce Obama now as the left-wing socialist, foreign-born Muslim traitor, but applaud his outrageous defenses and cover-ups of their crimes and his continuation of the same policies. Bill Clinton was a leftist, pinko, traitor, hippie, whose behavior was the legal justification in these documents for what Bush and Cheney did, expanding on his war-making procedures. Imagine for a moment the national shame and outrage if George W. Bush had gone to Oslo and given a Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech advocating the glories of war and promoting the use of war as a force for good in the world. Imagine the liberal pundits' fits of rage and disgrace. Why is there silence when Obama, for the first time in world history, accepts a Nobel Peace Prize with an infomercial for war? We have to think about these differences. There was a story, Democracy Now! Picked it up this morning. Others are beginning to pick it up. That's been reported in the Associated Press, although not a single US paper picked it up, in the English papers in recent days, that our puppet president in Afghanistan and the United Nations representative in Afghanistan had concluded that US-led troops had yanked students out of their beds and handcuffed and shot them to death. We don't know if this is true. We don't know the details. These things need to be investigated. But I wrote about this not to talk about this particular incident, but to say, if this grabs your attention, consider the fact that this is no different from any other day in these wars. That this is not worse, this is just smaller, this is more comprehensible. For the most part, we are killing people with unmanned aircraft. And we are killing civilians by the dozens, routinely. And the fact that we're not doing it close up with bullets doesn't make it any better. And when I wrote about this, people were absolutely outraged at me for writing about it. Because, as far as I can tell, the president belongs to a different political party now. Although I didn't say a word about the president. So I think we have to put an emphasis, aside from restoring not the balance of power, but the proper alignment of power, the vast majority of which belongs in the legislature, we have to put an emphasis on where war powers in particular belong and stop this universal agreement among those who support the wars and those who oppose the wars that the war decisions belong to the president. And the president is to be credited or blamed for his war making. This is incredibly dangerous. The war powers belong in the Congress, and the House of Representatives alone can end any war by ceasing to fund it. And the Senate and the President can do whatever they please, but they cannot fight wars if the House of Representatives stops funding them. And there are bills from the more progressive members in Congress saying, we don't want to fund an escalation, even though they just did it. And when they bring up another funding bill in the spring, we will all be told it's too late, the escalation's already happened, we have to now fund it. And there are bills to say, we want an exit plan, any exit plan. It can be, you know, move everybody to Taiwan in 85 years, or just an exit plan, whatever. There are nice bills. There's a bill to say, let's have a war tax to pay for the wars. And there's not much taking of 10 seconds to stop and think that if the House passes one of these bills, it has to be passed by the Senate and signed by the President, when the House could simply stop funding the wars. So I would encourage you to take a look at a website called defundwar.org, which charts where every Congress member stands on voting for more money for these wars. And to take a look at peaceoftheaction.org, where peace is spelled P-E-A-C-E, peaceoftheaction.org, which is organizing people to come to Washington, D.C. in March and do what any civilized nation would have done years ago and nonviolently shut the place down. And I would encourage you, whether or not you can come to Washington, D.C., to lobby your Congress members in the House locally without placing top priority on politeness. That is to say, they are killing people. And they need to be gone after in the media. Their working days and those of their staff need to be disrupted. You need to go and sit in their offices and not leave until they agree to leave Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq. If they have not yet passed this godforsaken corporate bailout of a health care bill, you need to cough a lot while you're sitting there in their office. We need to take this seriously and to behave as people behave in a representative republic following an election. We've behaved for a year as if we'd had a coup. And we were in the habit of having coups. We'd had two coups, but then we had an election. And people behaved as if we'd had a coup. We have to start, as many of you I know in this room have known for years, but we have to start putting activism after elections, not before it. I've been reading a book. I read most of it on the flight out here from the East Coast that I recommend everybody buy after they buy my book, called Europe's Promise, by a guy named Stephen Hill. And Europe is the same species of creature we are. They're Homo sapiens over there in Europe, right? And we're told that they've got everything wrong and their economy can't succeed and they're overtaxed and they're suffering under the evils of taxation and so forth. Never mind that they are bigger than us, with a bigger economy and a stronger economy than ours. They pay more taxes and they get paid more money. And they take home as much money as we do. And they get things for their taxes, right? They get paid vacations. They get paid paternal leave and maternal leave. They get paid pensions. They get paid free preschool through college. People in this country tend to have to pay for college on top of their wonderfully low taxes, which, by the way, when you add in the state and local and property taxes and all of the fees and so forth, not to mention college and everything else, you pay as much in taxes as the poor, suffering, overtaxed Europeans. And these are people, if you've read Harvey Wasserman's book, Ecotopia, on a future salvation of the planet through environmental sustainable innovations, you know, it's there. It's happening. These are people who have health care. We don't have to invent it, right? But what's interesting is the foreign policy of the European Union, which is carrots, and ours is only sticks, big, stupid sticks. They hold out to a country like Turkey the opportunity to join the European Union. And they spread democracy. They don't just talk about spreading democracy. They actually are spreading democracy. We pay a lot more money to do it. We bomb countries. And we spread nothing but hatred and resentment. So I encourage people to consider Europe's Promise. And I encourage people to think about what we can do nationally, but also at the state and local levels. And I would love to start reading books about Oregon's promise. You know, there are measures 66 and 67 that need to be voted yes on to have a little bit of progressive taxation in Oregon, and then you need to brag about it and tell the country, we just voted to raise taxes. That will be the biggest glaring headline anywhere. And why you did it. You have fusion voting here. Use that as an example to the other states. I also wanted to mention on measures 66 and 67, I got an email forwarded to me today from Steve Novick, who I recall as brave enough to advocate impeaching Cheney and Bush when he was running for office. These are the kind of people who need to be encouraged. I understand you have clean elections in this town. Other people need to hear about that and what difference it makes, and you need to have them in this state. But you can bring the National Guard home to Oregon. You can fund peace efforts. You can have a state Department of Peace, which we're not going to get for decades at the national level. You can sign international treaties as cities and states. You can create state single-payer health care. You can protect the environment in this state. And you can provide real family values like they have in Europe and we just dream about here at the state level. And we can start reading about Oregon's promise. And you know, the difference is not just philosophy and background between Europe and here, and the difference is not some variation in genetics. The difference is that they don't put all of their money into the military. That's the difference. And people tell me, well, we need a draft. If we had a draft, everything would be different. And it's true, everything would be different. I don't know that we can get one, or that if we could get one, we couldn't just stop the funding of the wars. But the fact is that the hardships that everyone is facing right now in this country, incredible hardships, are the direct result of all of the money going to the wars and the military. So we could get a draft and people would understand that, or we can persuade people to understand the current situation that we're actually in. And so I would advocate attempting that. But it's wonderful to be here, and I would love to take any questions that any of you might have. Yes, over here and then here.
This isn't really a question, but you said we could, you know, that Congress can stop funding war, and this is really true. But we've been, you know, lobbying them for a long time so that we do exactly that, right? In marching, we can have 35,000 people one time in Portland doing that. I suggest that people stop funding Congress, or i.e. stop paying the federal taxes for a while. There's all kinds of people that do this, and stop being so damn scared of the IRS. I do it, I got my house, and I'm not in jail. And if I were, I wouldn't mind. If I have to live under a bridge to get rid of war, that's fine with me too. But that hasn't happened so far. And I know people that have been, you know, defunding Congress, telling them why for a lot of years. We just need a lot more people to do it. It's like crossing, it's like jaywalking across the street. One person does it, you get a ticket. 10 people do it.
You get a movement. Thank you. It was right here and then back over there.
Yeah, thanks for your lecture. A couple questions, but I'll just ask one right now. You said that there's a major difference between the United States and Europe is the fact that they don't fund the military, a substantial military. Have you considered why they don't?
Well, they do fund a very substantial military, just nowhere remotely as outrageously oversized as ours.
So why? Why don't they have an outrageously oversized military?
Well, there are many reasons, and many of which I'm not an expert on, but they have a different history from ours. They are now outgrowing the generations that knew the horrors of war, but they knew them, and they didn't want it again. And their approach to the world is a much wiser one in many ways, growing out of a history of needing to interact and build consensus among disparate groups. And the nations within the European Union interact with each other in ways that help build the policies that they take to the rest of the world. They fund education much more. They are much better educated. They fund public media and newspapers and media, and they are much better informed. And the fact is that if you are educated and informed, then you know that the approach the United States is taking doesn't work. And the approach that Europe is taking works much better. So I don't know that we need a better explanation than that. But, you know, they have clean elections. They have decent media. They have openness to proportional representation and multiple parties and so forth. They have democracy richly built in to the structure of their corporations and their civic life. There are many reasons that they are better represented. And when the people are represented, the people don't choose to do the crazy, insane, murderous things that our government does in our name. Yes, way back over there. Yeah. Well, I take it that you actually agree with me that we get better bills out of the House than out of the Senate. And we always have, on every issue, with very few exceptions, for 2.25 centuries. The Senate is a drag. The Senate should be put out of its misery. Our Constitution has been tweaked for 225 years. It needs to be brought up to speed. We should not have this aristocratic, misrepresentative upper house with so much power. It should be eliminated. Short of eliminating the Senate, which requires amending the Constitution, it ought to be drastically improved by throwing out the filibuster rule, which the Democrats currently use as a wonderful excuse. Imagining that you don't know that 50 senators could throw it out tomorrow if they had the decency to do it. And by keeping it in place, they allow senators representing 11% of Americans to stop all legislation in the Senate, and therefore all legislation in the House that has to go through the Senate. There's nothing more anti-democratic outside of the Supreme Court and the Federal Reserve and the CIA and, well, I stopped there. But here's the thing. If you want to pass a bill under the current system, you generally have most bills you have to pass through both houses, which means you have to make the bill lousy enough to get it through the Senate. And then, of course, you get it through the House, too. But if you just want to stop unconstitutional, criminal, immoral, murderous bills, you only have to stop them in one house. And the other house can do whatever the hell it wants. And which house is it easier to stop things in? The people's house, the House of Representatives. If you want to stop a war, you only need to stop it in the House by stopping the funding in the House. And the Senate can throw trillions of dollars at it, but it doesn't matter. The House has to approve. If you want to subpoena or impeach someone or otherwise hold the other branches of government accountable, You only need the House. You only need a committee in the House. If you want to stop a bailout of Wall Street, you only need the House. So when you're in a situation where most of the bills do more harm than good, and you want to stop them, then you only need the House. But you're absolutely right if you want to pass a bill. I mean, everybody thinks only in terms of passing bills, and I wish that sometimes they would think in terms of stopping bills. But when you do want to think in terms of passing bills, you need both houses, and you have to make the bill bad enough to pass the Senate. There's no question. Yes, in the front row.
Back to the EU policy of not having war. How much is that dependent on our having a big army?
It's not an easy question.
Could you repeat it? Yeah.
The question was, do European nations not fight wars because the United States has a big army? Well, the question, of course, is not completely. I'm sorry. Do European nations not fund militaries and wars the way we do because we do it and protect them, presumably? I don't know. I think that they have a more than sufficient military strength to protect themselves from any actual wars on Europe were such things to occur. I think that just about everything we do with our enormous military, not to mention our sales of weapons abroad, makes things more dangerous for our friends and allies and ourselves, not less so. So I'm not sure that to any degree that makes sense. It is certainly the case that we have major military bases in many European countries and weapons and nukes in European countries with a great deal of resentment from them. And I used to live in Italy, and you could say I'm an American, and it was like saying I'm a rock star. And now you don't want to say it. And my friends in a town where we are building the biggest military base that there will be in Europe are incredibly, incredibly angry and resentful. And I don't think that if we got those bases out of there, they would be replaced by local ones, because the thinking is not there and the political corruption is not there to do it. Yes?
One of the reasons that Europe does not have a large military is they've seen war up close. Yeah. They saw it in World War I. They saw World War II. We had 3,000 people die in New York and freaked out. They lost 60 million people in Europe. That's why they don't have a huge military, because they learned that lesson. When it comes here, maybe we will learn here. But if they're smart, we'll look at what happened to Europe in the 40s and the 30s and the 20s and say, enough.
Well said. Very good. Much as I hate to defend the American people, in our defense, we are much more informed and much more active and much more able to build serious movements and struggle than most of us have any idea, than our televisions will ever tell us, than our corporate newspapers will ever tell us. There are people all across this country and many Americans in places like Gaza at the moment and elsewhere making great sacrifices for future generations in battles that must be fought, that are long and difficult to win. And in many cases, we are winning victories and not learning about it. We made the Iraq War illegal. We turned the United Nations against it. We will be able to prosecute it because of that. We have prevented an attack on Iran every day for years now by publicizing the lies that took us into Iraq. We have deterred recruitment to the military to a great extent, and these wars are being fought exactly to the extent that there are troops and mercenaries to do it. We would have the same level of war were McCain president, because it's the level of troops they've got to do it with. We win victories at the local and state levels all the time, and don't tell each other about it. As easy as it is to make comparisons to better times and better places and to wish we were better, and I certainly do, it's much more useful to look at the good that people are doing. And when the president early on in his Peace Prize acceptance speech spoke of the people who were more deserving of the prize than he himself, despite his willingness to accept it, I thought of dozens of them that came to mind, people all over this country who've ruined their family lives, spent their retirement savings, driven themselves into poor health to fight the crimes being so nonchalantly committed by these people in Washington. So there is a lot to be encouraged about. I don't think we should become so victory dependent and success dependent. I don't think we should only be willing to get involved when we see that we're already winning. I think we should get involved because we have a moral responsibility to get involved, and it's a lot more fun to get involved than to sit home and bitch about it. But if there are, I know this is the crowd that gets that. So I'm with you. Yes, Barbara. Well, I hope that you, Barbara or Joe or somebody, is passing around a clipboard here this evening, or will do so now, because if there are people here who have not been involved in the wonderful local campaigns to go after Bybee and to pressure local Congress members, you should get involved, because there's a great deal of leadership and experience here to be drawn on and built upon, and it is far more fun to do so, no matter how long it takes us to win. Yes, way over here.
Do you agree that we have a current threat towards our country? If you do, how do you view addressing that? I mean, I think Obama's move to increase the troop level in Afghanistan would be the most pivotal moment in his presidency.
The most what moment? I'm sorry?
The most pivotal moment in his foreign policy, whether it's a right move will be determined in the future. But I think he viewed there was a serious threat in Afghanistan, and went ahead and increased the troop level based upon that. Do you agree with that there's a serious threat in Afghanistan? And if you do, how do you think America should approach that?
The question is largely whether I agree with the questioner and the president that there is a serious threat to us in Afghanistan. And what I think of the president's decision to escalate the troop levels there. And I think that if we are to imagine that these fewer than 100 members of Al-Qaeda there in Afghanistan do indeed have superhuman powers, and that it does make sense for us to have thousands of troops per capita there with unmanned aircraft and tanks and massive bases to go after them when they take off their capes and we're able to spot them, then I think it makes perfect sense. But I think the justification that the president uses is still tied to revenge for 9/11 and going after terrorists and going after Al-Qaeda. because that was built into the unconstitutional authorization to use force that he's still using as cover for this. Hence, the resulting need to use that nonsensical argument that we need all these tens of thousands of troops to go after these fewer than 100 people. If, on the other hand, you are considering the mission to be going after the Taliban, which, by the way, is not Al-Qaeda, but is the Taliban, and really pacifying the nation of Afghanistan and all its valleys, then, according to every estimate by the U.S. military, we needed to put in hundreds of thousands of troops to have any sort of impact. Because he is a cowardly, immoral fool whose advisors told him that if he wants to get elected in 3 years, he had to do it. And if you are willing to kill people and to put people's lives at risk who signed up for the military because you wouldn't invest in any other industry in this country in order to boost your chances of winning an election, you've lost any shred of a soul. And I think that it is incredibly shameful. And I think the most discouraging part about that most pivotal decision in Obama's presidency is that we accept that it can be his decision. It cannot. It is up to Congress to fund it or not, and they have to not fund it. And if he had made the other decision, regardless, it cannot be up to him, and it cannot be left up to every future president to make those decisions, because guess what? They're all going to come down on the same side that he did. We had the military publicly pressuring the president to make that decision. They should be tried for treason. In the yellow shirt, and then over here, and here. Well, we're quite open about the fact that we want an oil pipeline in Afghanistan. We are, without any ability to disguise it, building massive permanent bases in Afghanistan. When we decide that the perfect war is fought with unmanned drones because none of the right people will be put at risk, and then 5 CIA agents and 2 Blackwater mercenaries are blown up by another CIA agent because in response and revenge for these drone strikes that are killing so many civilians, that's blowback. Blowback is when you imagine that you're imposing suffering on the rest of the world and shielding yourself from risk. And you can't. It can't be done. You cannot protect this country by strip searching airline passengers and building a wall along Mexico. It can't be done. You have to stop making everyone passionately hate you. And you know, it begins with ceasing to bomb them. Let's take a few more questions and then sign books and talk one-on-one. Yes, it was here, and then there were 2 in the front row.
Yeah, David, you point out that, you know, our Congress and our administration have been very corrupt. But I'm wondering, how is it that you would give a pass to the official story of 9/11? When in fact it's the seminal and the hinge again, which creates the excuse and the fear and everything else that goes on. And that's the first part of my question. If you go so far as to say, well, yes, we need to look at it, and I think I'm coming from some words that you expressed previous to this event, that something substantive in an investigation needs to happen, then how would you get behind it? Would you get behind it? And have you really given a pass sent to these same people who are so corrupt? Wouldn't you think they did 9/11?
There are many horrible things that have happened in recent years, and there are a few of them that Dick Cheney didn't do. He did a lot of them, and he did many of them, many thousands of times worse than 9/11. Most of them, as you note, justified by propaganda built up around 9/11. Having worked on an article of impeachment against George W. Bush for allowing 9/11 to happen, I don't think I've been entirely complicit. I don't have any question that treating that crime as an act of war and launching a vague war on the world because of it has been the undoing of our country these 9 years. I have demanded and joined with many others in demanding a serious investigation of what happened. Now, I have no doubt that what you think happened didn't happen, and you have no doubt that what I think happened didn't happen, but we can agree that we need a serious investigation, which everyone knows has never happened. So I'm with you up to that point, if it's helpful. Let's go to the front row.
David, I've been sitting in this room for a little over 2 years now, listening to every progressive author that hits our streets.
Should sleep and eat.
Not much. And they all follow a pattern that you have as well. You did an excellent job in chronicling the shortcomings of not only our government, but I think our society and culture as a whole. And like every other progressive writer, your solution is to become more active, to, in your case, your particular emphasis on Congress. Well, everybody has a particular pet methodology of trying to regain our country. But it isn't working. You said we had a coup a year ago. I submit we had a coup 9 years ago, 10 years ago now. It didn't wake up the American public then.
That is what I said. I did agree with you.
And it isn't waking up the public now. And here in this room, we all meet and we all agree with whatever writer is on the podium, and we go out a little more enthusiastic. But the point is that we are the point of the progressive sphere, and we can't remotely put a dent or even a scratch.
Bullshit.
Into the
bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. Listen.
After Barack Obama has done this and he has completely sold us out, I wish you could convince me. I don't believe you.
What in the world did you expect him to do? If you expected him to do anything different from what he has done, you have not been paying attention for decades.
I didn't expect him to be a complete and total corporate whore.
I did.
Well, then you perhaps have better insight than I.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think it took a lot of genius. I think it took looking straightforwardly at who he was and what the system is that he was being inserted into. And I think that pointing out where we've failed and where we need to push harder and strategies that aren't working and strategies that might work better, we have to do that, even if it's ugly, even if it's painful, even if it's discouraging to say, hey, that's not working. But to sit here and tell people you cannot succeed, you cannot do it, we're failing, let's stop because it's not working.
No, that's not what I said at all. No, what I'm saying is that our strategies aren't working. I think it's demonstrable. We cannot get a tipping point to really make an influence now with the corporate influence of Congress. So therefore, my solution is, and this is my final part of the question, I think we, other than just saying get active, we have to take it at the next step. Would you please consider, if you haven't already, your next book to be a how-to manual to take to the streets to save our country?
Did you read this one?
No, I just... is that in fact what you have done?
I would encourage you to do two things. Read the book, which is, to the best attempt I could make, a how-to manual for how to take back the country, not just in the streets, but in the offices, in the front doorways of their homes and everywhere that we can put a wrench into this murderous system. But secondly, and more importantly, and then we're going to take, I think there was one more question, I'll be glad to talk with you for hours afterwards, but I'm going to sign books. Secondly, understand the difference between the intellectual analysis of what's working and what's not working, and the moral responsibility not to cough defeatism on your brothers and sisters sitting around you in a room. It is not morally wise. It has nothing to do with your correct understanding and analysis of what's been happening. It is a moral failure to do it, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It encourages others to think they can't succeed, and they damn well can. And I love to talk with you afterwards, but we're not going to take...
That's not my opinion. That's my question.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it.
David, I'm just going to follow up with my comment here. In just another way to ask that question, what system... I also concur that the system is broke. What do you envision as a system that would actually work?
Matter of fact, I've written a book about that, and maybe we should read it. My website is davidswanson.org. My email is there. My phone number is there. I would love to hear what you think about it. I mentioned very briefly that we don't actually have to invent a system that works, because Europe has one. But I'd love to talk with you about any aspect of the system, but I don't know how to do it in 1 minute. This is going to be the very last question right here.
Thank you. It's related. Thank you for leading up, because my question is, how do you do it? I'm not looking for how to in this world. I'm amazed that people like you and Kucinich, they give me this inspiration to keep moving on. I tend to look at things cynically. I kind of think that maybe the tipping point is so major, like global warming taking us down or the economy taking us down to this point. At the same time, I fight because it gives me purpose of my life on Earth. And when I listen to Kucinich, Dennis Kucinich, I just want to know how you guys do it, how you keep this attitude that Barbara was saying is this inspirational, and even though it's cynical, it's great. It's good that way. It's good to critique, and at the same
well,
time...
Dennis is older than I am, and I can't keep up with him. And he would tell you that it's being a vegan. So that's one answer. My answer is that, like Dennis, I get paid for what I do. I don't have to do it all on weekends and evenings, as some people do, who do more than I do, incredibly enough. And I enjoy it, and I can't imagine what the point would be of living doing anything other than what I think morally most needs to be done. And there are medical studies that will show you that it is good for your health to engage in this struggle, and it is bad for you not to. It has absolutely nothing to do with whether you're about to win next Thursday or not.
Joe said you have to laugh.
You do have to laugh, and Joe will help you do it. And thank you all for being here. I'd love to talk with you informally.